Just before I start, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the title. The book went through various iterations in terms of its title, and at one point it was actually going to be called Japan as Number 3. For those of you who are familiar with Japan, there was a book in the late 70s called Japan as Number 1. This was when Japan was surging, when Americans began to be a little bit nervous of Japan. And Reischauer, who was the ambassador to Japan, the Japanese were taking this all very seriously, and they were talking about the British disease and the American disease. And Reischauer said that this book ought to be mandatory reading in America and banned in Japan. Now, Japan as Number 3 was a title, but instead I've gone with this, Bending Adversity. Now, the reason for that is that the catalyst, in a way, for me writing this book was the tsunami and earthquake of 2011. I had left Japan by this stage. I was actually in Beijing when the earthquake struck. But I flew a couple of days later to Japan, covered the story from Tokyo at first, and then went a couple of days later up to the northeast where the tsunami had struck. Now, I made a phone call very early on to an old friend of mine who had been the vice governor of the Bank of Japan. And we were talking, and he suddenly said something to me, which I'd never heard before, which was, for those of you who speak Japanese, wazowai o tenjite, fuku tonas, and which I had never heard. So I went away and looked it up, and it means something like, I mean, actually the dictionary definition is make the best of a bad lot, or something like that. I gave it a kind of a literal translation, which was bend adversity and turn it into fortune or happiness. And this guy really liked this translation, and so it stuck in my mind as a possible title for the book. And so I've written a book, in a sense, about a country that I think sees itself to some extent as primed for adversity. Remember, Japan sits on the off the edge of this massive Eurasian continent, close, although not that close, in fact 500 miles from China, the great dominating civilization of the region. It also obviously sits in a region which is prone to earthquakes, tsunamis. Mount Fuji could blow at any time. So there's this kind of sense of impermanence, which to a certain extent I think Japan gets a certain sucker from and derives a certain strength. Let me just make sure I've got the right... this is the one I want. Now, the sort of the caricature of the way that Japan changes is that there are long periods of stasis where nothing happens, followed by an explosion. But as Bill Emmett, who reviewed my book, said, there are really only two data points for this, and these are the two data points. The first is when Commodore Perry shows up in 1853, I think is the date, showing the might of America, the might of the West, and Japan changes seemingly overnight. The Meiji Restoration ditches feudalism, 250 years of being closed, modernizes, gets a parliament, industrializes, and then seeks to become an empire in its own right, and you know the rest of the story. And the way that story ends, of course, is in total defeat and destruction. And this is the second data point, because after the rubble of the war, and the rubble of the war reminded my friend at the Bank of Japan, or the destruction of the tsunami reminded him of the rubble of the war, of course Japan changed direction sharply again. Instead of seeking to become a quote-unquote great power by conquering other nations, it sought to become one by becoming rich. However, I think that this is, in a sense, not how Japan changes. John Dower, who is a great historian of modern Japan, said, for example, that there had been many, many changes going on in Tokugawa Japan in the 250 years when Japan was closed. And so Japan was kind of primed to meet the challenge of the American ships and Commodore Perry. This didn't come from nowhere. In other words, and I think Japan is, in many ways, an adaptive, evolutionary society. And I wanted to approach contemporary Japan, really, with that in mind. Now, there's a picture of Issei shrine here, or a part of Issei shrine. Issei supposedly was founded in the 3rd century. It's actually not one shrine. There are 125 shrines. It's in a large area. I described it as like Hyde Park with gods. The thing about Issei is that although it's 1,800 years old, it is being continually rebuilt. There's a 20-year cycle, and every 20 years you have a new Issei, but constructed in exactly the same format. So the question of whether Issei is 1,800 years old or 20 years old is rather a moot point. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about how Japan changes. It may be useful for thinking about how other nations change as well. But in the case of Japan, I think, this nation is able to change quite dramatically, but it's sort of made of the same stuff. So you can recognize Japan's history, you know, even today in modern Japan. So adapting, changing, even changing radically, but made of the same stuff. Kissinger, who actually didn't like Japan very much, he described it to Zhou Enlai. He said that the Japanese, he called them a tribal nation. He said they were so confident of their own essence that they were able to change overnight because the essence of Japan wouldn't change in the process. And that is why, in his opinion, Japan was able to, for example, go through the Meiji Restoration, which was such a dramatic change. And again, you know, I don't particularly like doffing my cap to Kissinger, but I think it's not a bad description of how Japan changes. So I wanted to write about contemporary Japan in this way. Another sort of feature of my book, I think, is that we tend to think of Japan, the caricature of Japan is that it's a consensual society, it's very top-down, hierarchical, you know, everybody thinks more or less the same. I mean, you know, you will hear Japanese people tell you that at times. You won't find that in my book. You'll find Japanese people arguing about lots of things. You're about arguing about history, arguing about the merits of haiku poetry, arguing about whether they should stand up when the national anthem is played. And you get people from all sorts of political persuasions, all sorts of views about their own society. I write about women, I write about youth, I write about politics, I write about Fukushima in this context. Now, I'm not going to tell you about it because I want you to buy the book. Now I want to move on to contemporary Japan. This bunch of rocks you may or may not recognize as the Senkaku, called the Diaoyu in China. It's interesting that it's called the Diaoyu in China and that I know that, because 3 or 4 years ago I didn't know that it was called the Diaoyu really, or it was not a name that tripped off my tongue. But now this is a bunch of rocks with some goats and moles as residents. That is now one of the big fault lines in the world. And the Taiwan Strait is no longer the explosive point in Asia. This is. Mr. Pitsuan, Surin Pitsuan, who was the Secretary General of ASEAN, called it Asia's Palestine. That's a very emotive phrase, but I think with some resonance. Very briefly, Japan incorporated these islands into its territory in 1895. China's interpretation of that is that it stole them because Japan and China happened to be at war in that year. Japan said, no, 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 this was before. And the rest is history, or the rest is contentious history. What does China want? Because there's all sorts of, you read all sorts in the press, and the most common, or a very common thing that you read is it's all about oil. I think newspapers love to say it's all about oil. It's all about fish, which seems to be even odder. Now, I don't think it's about oil or fish or oily fish or any combination of those. I think this is about history. It's about China's humiliation, sense of humiliation from the West, and specifically humiliation at the hands of Japan, this little pipsqueak island, little brother that came and tried to take it over when it was weak. And I think... whether China wants these islands back or not. I think actually they do want them, quote unquote, back. But they certainly want to use these islands to establish the fact that that China is back. China is now the big brother again, and Japan needs to be very worried. I think these islands also have a strategic value. China is used to being kind of pressed along its coast by the American power, America, which has kept the Pax Americana since 1945. This is a rather sort of, I think this will be seen as a historical aberration. And China, I think, if it continues to grow as it has been, will want to push away from the coast. And in order to do that, these islands are part of what China would call the first island chain. They come with their own EEZ, exclusive economic zone. In other words, more sea. So I think there's a real strategic value to this to these islands. So you can see the China-Japan clashes, thankfully mainly verbal, that we're seeing at the moment. You can see them through this kind of geopolitical fault line that I think is existing as China rises and as American supremacy comes under question. But I think there's another way. Yes, there is another way of looking at the same situation, which is a biographical way. Now, yes, my phrase is up there, history is a rotting corpse at the end of the diplomatic garden. I apologize for that phrase, but it is in my book. And it's somehow, I mean, I sort of conceive of history as this zombie, this body that you keep trying to bury, and it keeps rearing up and sort of marching ever forward. And the strange thing about history in Northeast Asia, the history of the 1930s and 1940s, I mean, is that the further we get away from it, the more alive and poisonous this history has become. Now, these three leaders of Japan, China, and South Korea, extraordinarily are not talking to each other. But the South Korean leader Park and Xi Jinping are talking, but Park is not talking to Abe, and Xi Jinping is not talking to Abe. I mean, if you can conceive of that in Europe, you know, this is Merkel and Hollande not talking. This is Cameron refusing to step foot on the continental Europe. I mean, it could happen, but I doubt it. Now, Abe's grandfather on his mother's side is Kishi. Kishi, as many of you will know, ran Manchuria. He ran the kind of industrial complex during the war. He was arrested as a Class A war criminal by the Americans, but then let out. The Americans became more nervous about communism than they did about the kind of revisionist right, or in fact those who had really been involved in the build-up to war. So Kishi was let out, and Kishi became prime minister. And I think, you know, if you've read Abe's autobiography, it begins with him sitting on his grandfather's knee. Kishi is a hugely important figure in Abe's life. It's not just a personal thing, although I think it is personal. It's also that Kishi represents the judgment of Japan, as uniquely evil, let's say, in its actions in the Second World War. The fact that it's not allowed to have an army, the fact that it's, you know, tied up in this pacifist constitution, and the fact that it's, this is all from Abe's perspective, I should add, continually asked to apologize. So who are the other two leaders? So there's Park Geun-hye of Korea, South Korea. Her father was a man called Masao Takagi, otherwise known as Park Chung-hee, who became the dictator and leader of South Korea during its kind of explosive economic phase. He was in the Japanese Imperial Army, and during the Cold War, he was very much allied with Japan because, again, he disliked communism more than he disliked the Japanese. Now, that is no longer tenable for Park Geun-hye in South Korea. She needs to distance herself, which is why her first visit was to Xi Jinping, and it's why she has not, she won't talk to Abe and is very firm on Abe. Just finally, Xi Jinping, his father, Xi Jong-shun, who who fought with Mao, fought against the Japanese as a rebellious force, and then became the Secretary General of Guangdong Province, which was the province of China's opening and reform. And as China opened and reformed, it had to lean back, or it didn't have to, but it chose to lean back on the kind of the nationalist card, because there was really no ideology. Communism was ripped up as an ideology, so the Chinese Communist Party could bring growth, and it could bring the narrative that it was it that had defeated the Japanese, it was it that stood up for a strong China. And so you've got, so in other words, you've got these three people, they're fighting their fathers, their grandfathers' battles. Now I'm actually probably going to, because I've gone on a bit, so I'm going to skip all this, but you can, this is the apology. Now let me just go back. So I am going to talk briefly about the economy, and I'll come back right at the end to to the history question and the Japan-China question. So Japan after the bubble. So Japan grows incredibly rapidly until 1990, and then you have this enormous collapse of the bubble in terms of asset prices that were wiped out, something like 2.5 times Japan's GDP, and that is deeper than the 1929 shock, and certainly deeper than the Lehman shock. This was extraordinary. Now, so then you get Japan in this period of, you know, the so-called lost decades. So I turn up in 2002. The reason for this picture, forget the Murakami, I want you to concentrate on the cat. I show up in Japan in 2002. I open my fridge. In my fridge is an envelope. On the envelope, it says cat money. And in the envelope is 30,000 yen. So I concluded two things from this. One is it is really expensive to feed a cat in Japan. And the second, slightly more profound, possibly, point is that the fridge is actually a really good place to keep your money, or was a very good place to keep your money. Remember, Japan was at this point gripped by deflation and had been for several years and would be for several years more. Now, I did a quick calculation, a back-of-the-envelope calculation. If you'd have put 100,000 yen in the fridge in 1995 and taken it out in 2012, that money would have been worth about 112,000 yen in real prices, because prices had, cost of living had fallen, and so that money was worth more. If you'd have invested it in the stock market, it would have halved in value, and so good was the stock market performance. If you'd have put it in the bank, it would have been worth roughly 112,000 yen, just like in the fridge. But you would have had the inconvenience of bank charges, of traveling to and fro to the bank. So the fridge was really your best bet. Now, any economy in which the fridge is the best bet is in a sort of a peculiar state, let's say. Martin Wolf, my colleague, described deflation as a sorcerer's apprentice of debt, a machine for making a bad situation worse. Because if you borrow money in the normal run of affairs, then as you get inflation, that debt becomes easier and easier to pay. You've all experienced that if you've ridden the housing boom in Britain. In a deflationary situation, of course, exactly the opposite pertains. And that has all sorts of negative consequences for an economy. So this is Japan. Japan is the red line, and as you can see, flatlining. This is where the idea of the lost decades comes from. So while Japan went precisely nowhere from 1990 to 2012, you can see that Germany doubled in size. This is in nominal terms. And the US and the UK, 2.5 times bigger. And this is the consequence, the explosion of debt to GDP, which everybody is so worried about. 250% of GDP, roughly, or getting on for. Unprecedented for an advanced economy. Just imagine if it had grown at the same pace as the UK and the US, then that line would be flat. The line that's... However, there's a but. There's going to be a but to the but in a minute as well, but there's a but. Look again. So this is real GDP per capita. This is taking out the deflationary experience. Japan doesn't look nearly so bad. In fact, Japan performs more or less exactly the same as all the other advanced economies. A little bit worse, but not that much worse. So you could say, well, what's the problem? And indeed you could. I mean, Japan was in a sort of a deflationary equilibrium. And I could go through other numbers that would show, for example, productivity actually very strong. That would show debt as a percentage, debt payments as a percentage of GDP, very low, lower than Britain, in fact, because you can borrow money at such incredibly low levels. Remember the fridge. So what is wrong? Well, deflation kills what economists call animal spirits. In a deflationary situation, you know that the economy is going to be smaller next year, smaller again the year after, smaller again the year after. Your incentive to invest, to take risks, to gamble, to have children, is really taken away under those circumstances. Deflation looks like a kind of a game with, you know, no end or an unhappy end, let's say. So bring on Abenomics. Now, what is Abenomics? I mean, this is going to be very, very brief. So Abenomics, really, in my opinion anyway, is a statement that deflation can be defeated. And remember, for 15 years, the Bank of Japan, which was in charge, supposedly, of tackling deflation, said, actually, there's not much we can do about it. It's the government that needs to do it. Abenomics actually turns that on its head and says, no, the Bank of Japan can defeat deflation. It declares an inflation target of 2%, and then it hits it, does whatever is needed to hit it. And as soon as that happened, I don't have the chart here, but you saw the yen. In fact, as soon as it was announced, before the Bank of Japan did anything at all, just the announcement effects of that sent the yen plummeting in value, the stock market soaring. As you know, Japan's stock market rose 60% last year, one of the best performing stock markets in the world. The yen went down, making Japanese exports more competitive, you know, raising the prospect, and I emphasize prospect, the possibility of a kind of a virtuous circle. If this inflationary target is met. I'm not going to go into that now, but you may want to quiz me about that when we have questions. Now, these are two economist covers. You know, one, Abe is soaring away. The other is like the man who jumps out of the building and someone asks, how's it going? And he says, so far, so good. Japan could fizzle out. This inflationary attempt could just kind of go nowhere. You could have Abegeddon. Or, you know, strangely, it could even work. Now, if it works, what will Japan look like? Well, if it works, Japan would be in a much better shape. It would have 2% inflation, perhaps 1% real growth, maybe even for a few years a bit more than that. It'd be growing at 3.5%, 4%. Suddenly your debt starts to kind of decrease a bit. People start to invest, maybe. Wages start to go up. People start to spend more. There is a possibility, and I stress, no more than that, of this, you know, improving this deflationary picture that I've painted for you. Now, it doesn't solve all Japan's problems. Japan still has myriad problems. I will go through them all now, but it doesn't make Japan more international. It doesn't put women in work. It doesn't produce more babies. You cannot print babies. So this makes Japan look prettier. It puts it in a better light, but it's not a panacea. Now, I'm just going to flick through these briefly. This is what Japan wants to do. This is what Abe wants to change, really, the post-war settlement. You have, you know, America kind of looming in the background. I'm not saying he wants America to go. In fact, the kind of irony of the Japanese rightists is that they cling very firmly to America while resenting the American post-war settlement. But I want to end with this picture, just because it's kind of funny. I mean, I think that there's a term that many of you will be familiar with, Fukoku Kyohei, which means rich nation, strong army. And this was the rallying cry. It was actually taken from China, as so many things in Japan were taken from China. It was a warring states phrase in China. But this became the rallying cry of the Meiji Restoration. We need a strong economy so that we can have a strong army and defend ourselves against, you know, these terrible Americans who want to prize us open. And I think that this is kind of the key to Abenomics. I think this is why you've had this sudden about change. So the change, if you like, has been forced by 20 years of deflation, to on the margins by the earthquake and tsunami and the energy crisis that followed that when all the nuclear power stations were turned off, but principally by a rising China, the nervousness of the establishment in Japan. And I think Abe just thinks, look, unless we have a strong economy, which we have not been able to produce with our current policies, unless we get a strong economy, we are not in a position to defend ourselves. And therefore, I think Abe has taken what is this gamble. He's bought some very bold advice, and he's, you know, in a sense, flipped Japanese economic policy on its head. But I do think that there is a nationalist element to this, if you will. I'll leave it there. I think Gideon's now going to quiz me, and then we'll open it up.
Great. Thank you very much, David. I thought I'd start just by picking up on the title of Bending Adversity, because one of the questions that's always baffled me, I've never really settled in my own head when thinking about Japan and visiting there, is how bad is the situation? I mean, you could paint a doomsday scenario, both in economics and in security policy, that debt eventually becomes unserviceable, with 220% of GDP, and you get a collapse in living standards as the economy kind of implodes under the weight of debt. And as you point out, they have this big, scary, resentful country just right next door to them. If you were Japanese, would you be very worried about the future?
Yes, I think you could be very worried on both counts. I think the first count is slightly less worrying than the second. Japanese debt, remember, is owed principally to other Japanese people. This is a very sort of circular, you know, people put their money in the bank and then the government borrows it, basically, instead of taxing people. See, tax rates have plummeted since 1990. So in a sense, you could say that instead of taxing people, they've borrowed their savings. And will they ever get their savings back? Well, that sort of depends on how this is worked out. But then it's all, in a sense, very circular. At the moment, of course, what the Bank of Japan is doing is taking a lot of these bonds onto its balance sheet. So by the end of this exercise, even if it doesn't expand this exercise, it could have about a quarter of Japanese bonds, debts, on its books. Now, it may decide to act as though it were a commercial bank.
So what, the central bank owes it to the Treasury?
Yes. It may decide to act as though it's a commercial bank. It could simply write that off and say, well, let's call it quits. So we don't, you know, it doesn't necessarily end in tears. It may do. And it probably has less chance of ending in tears under a mild inflationary scenario than under a chronic deflationary one, which is, I think, the reason for Abenomics. Of course, the you know, inflation also has its risks. Inflation could get out of control, the money could be debased, you could have capital flight, the whole thing could implode. You've got, you know, I should add demographics, which you know, don't look pretty. At the moment, 25% of the population is over 65. That could be 40%, I think, by 2050. You know, that raises questions about the dependency ratio, who pays for pensioners, how dynamic the working population is. I tend to think that some of those fears are overdone, and that demographics is not necessarily the terror that people make it out to be. I mean, after all, a country with fantastic demographics is Pakistan, and it's not done so well. So demographics is not necessarily destiny, I think. And, you know, I don't take particularly seriously this idea. There was a Japanese health minister who stood up and said, if we go on like this, the Japanese race will be extinct by the year 3000. I somehow think, you know, people will learn how to have babies before then, and something will change, either because of policy or because of some kind of almost automatic stabilizer. I really do not think the Japanese race, so-called race, is heading for an extinction. Now, the second part of your question is not in Japanese hands. A lot of that is in Japanese hands, you see. The second part of the question is not entirely in Japanese hands. In fact, it's largely in the hands of other nations, principally China. So it very much depends how China plays that. And there, of course, you know, we don't know. I mean, I can speculate. But just to sum up, I think Japan is in a bad situation for two reasons, really. So as China rises, Japan is both America's representative, the unsinkable aircraft carrier, on this kind of fault line, which is, you know, a rising China and a potentially declining America. And, you know, there's this talk about this Thucydides trap when you get a rising nation trying to come into the sort of status quo. You know, since the 15th century, there have been 15 examples of this, and 11 have ended in war. So this is a tricky situation, let's say, to deal with. And there you have Japan as America's representative. Japan is not only America's representative, it's also Japan. It's also the power that broke with China, the little brother that said, we don't want to be Confucian anymore. We want to be a Western power. We want to be a European great power. Oh, and we're going to invade you. And then they lost, and then they're sitting there, and China couldn't do anything about it. And hey, you know what? Now China can. So that's a pretty dangerous situation. I'm not predicting it's all going to end in war or conflict, but clearly you can see that it's a tricky spot to be in, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, you, in your presentation on the Senkakus, seem to me to stress the aggression that's coming from the Chinese side, and that seems to me pretty self-evident. Do you think, though, that Japan is also guilty for making the situation worse? And I don't think, let's not go into the, you know, buying of the islands and all of that complicated stuff that diplomats like to argue about. But more broadly, I quite often hear from, say, American diplomats who are in the middle of this trying to sort it out, that they're almost as worried by the nationalism of Abe as they are by the nationalism of Xi Jinping. They think this is a new nationalist generation in Japanese politics, which is pushing things, really pushing China back in the
I think there's, you know, they're two sides of the same coin, really. You know, if China pushes, Japan pushes back. If Japan pushes back, China pushes harder. That's why the situation is pretty complicated. I mean, Japan does not admit there is a dispute, which I think is really quite funny. So as a journalist, if you're sitting in Tokyo and you call up Gaimasho, the foreign ministry, and say, you know, hey, what about this dispute between China and Japan over the Senkaku Diaoyu? They will say, what dispute? And you say, well, you know, that China's saying it's theirs and they're going to take it back and, you know, it's not Japanese. And they say, no, it's everybody knows that it's Japanese. Everybody recognizes it's Japanese. The Japanese don't even admit that, you know, what would appear to be common sense, that there is a bit of a dispute here. Mm-hmm. So when they, quote-unquote, nationalized the islands, three of the islands had been in private hands, when they decided to buy them, and there's a whole backstory to that, but when they decided to buy them, in Japan's view of the world, view of those islands, nothing had changed. It was like, you know, I don't know, Big Ben being owned by somebody and then Britain taking it back as a, you know, but it was moving it around within Japan. As far as the Chinese were concerned, Japan had completely thrown down the gauntlet, had changed the status quo. There's this. They go back to this a meeting that I think it was Zhou Enlai, and I think it was Tanaka, where Zhou Enlai apparently said, this is when they were trying to normalize relations in the 70s, and Zhou Enlai apparently said, so we'll leave the dispute over the islands for future generations to solve. And in the Chinese record, Tanaka says, yeah, okay. And in the Japanese record, he nods, just politely, just to acknowledge that Zhou Enlai has said this. The Japanese now dispute that this was ever... Anyway, you know, who knows? I mean, it's all kind of kids in the playground, isn't it? But from the Chinese point of view, yes, Japan has changed the status quo.
And the last question from me before I invite questions from the audience. But this is also framed in the context of the deep resentment in China and, as you pointed out, in South Korea, to Japan's attitude to history. And, you know, as a very occasional visitor to Japan, it is surprising and indeed shocking. If you go to Yasukuni, you see, you know, the demonstrations for the Zero Fighter all sort of presented as something rather admirable, the statement from the Indian judge, the dissenting judge at the War Crimes Tribunal that eventually the historical verdict would be reversed and the people who were regarded as sinners would be rehabilitated. I mean, that's out there, and that appears to be the view. How unrepentant, if you like, are the Japanese, and how much is that part of the problem?
Well, I think, this is the kind of the touchstone issue, in a sense. I mean, I don't think you can talk about the Japanese for a start. I mean, yeah. There is a left in Japan,
yeah.
which is, you know...
Well, to qualify, the people in power, because again, okay. From the Americans who say, look, these guys are actually faintly dangerous, they say, sure, absolutely, there's a division of opinion in Japan, but as it happens, the ones who are in power
sure.
are precisely the revisionists.
And the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, has been in power for quite a long time, basically since the war with a couple of gaps. Mm. Parts of the LDP, I think, they are quote-unquote unrepentant. I mean, their view, and I mean, I could just go back to that slide maybe, which I didn't mm-hmm. show. Their view is something like... Oops, sorry. This isn't working very well. Okay, well, this isn't, in fact, their view, but this is maybe an explanation. So their view is that, Japan invaded other countries just like Britain had done, or Portugal or Spain. Bad things happened, as they do in war. They lost. But they were then judged to have been, as I use this phrase, and it's a deliberately emotive phrase, really, uniquely evil. Mm. Nanjing Massacre, chemical warfare... vivisections,
comfort women.
Comfort women, yeah. Now, this has an impact. So these are the reasons why I think Japan has not been able as a nation to come to a conclusion in the way that, let's say, Germany did. I mean, first of all, what Japan did and what Germany did, they are different. So I think it is difficult to compare those. I mean, Germany, the Nazis... had as a goal wiping out a group of people, Jews. Mm. The Japanese, however brutal their tactics, however much they strayed outside the rules of war in their attacks on civilians and rape and all the rest of it, it was a more conventional war. It wasn't an annihilation program. Then there's this, which... You see, Germany's view of the war is the Holocaust. Japan's view of the war is this. It's the bombing of Hiroshima, the bombing of Nagasaki. And it's quite hard for the Japanese to think they were uniquely evil, uniquely attacked civilians, when, there's this proof there in that picture that, tens of thousands of people were immolated in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and, of course, by the firebombing of Tokyo. Now, I've got the emperor there as well. MacArthur, as you know... decided to keep the emperor in place because he thought Japan would be ungovernable if the emperor were tried. So the Tokyo War Tribunal, which judged these war criminals, the 14 Class A war criminals, it exonerated the emperor by suppressing all sorts of... in fact, Tojo made a statement that then had to be struck from the record because he basically made a mistake. So the emperor was, in a sense, quite ludicrously... said to have known nothing about what was going on. And so the Japanese people who there was tremendous censorship as well, so it's actually kind of difficult to work out exactly what had been going on. Censorship, of course, during the war, but then censorship by the Americans after the war. The Japanese, many Japanese, I'm sure, kind of thought, well, if the emperor in whose name all this was done isn't guilty, then, it's quite hard to kind of look within your own soul. Just to sum this up, you had something called the reverse course, which was in 1952 when the Korean War started about that time. The Americans under MacArthur had kind of... They were making a New Deal society. It was all quite sort of radical in many ways. And in about this time, they decided that communism was more dangerous than these guys that had led this... the march to empire. This is why Kishi was let out, and then Kishi became prime minister. So that's why you've got the LDP representing, or you know, the right wing of the LDP, because the Americans let them out, in a sense. They let them out of the bag. And then just finally, the reconciliation that you saw in Europe between Germany and France, that was impossible in Asia, because Germany and France, i.e. Japan and China, were on opposite sides of the Cold War fence. So they couldn't reconcile. They weren't allowed to. Geopolitics did not allow that as a possibility. And so this kind of history has got frozen in aspic. And it's only really with the fall of the Berlin Wall and that it's kind of come out. That's why I think of it as this zombie. And, you know, it's kind of marching along today.
Okay. Thanks, David. I'm sure there are lots of questions. Do you like to stick up your hands here? Gentleman over here. If you could also, as well as asking the question, say who you are. It's always helpful.
Hello. That the textbooks will now be guided, or at least edited, by government-appointed academics to reflect kindly on Japan. I, as an academic, I found that more frightening than anything else
sure.
I've said or done.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I actually don't know the ins and outs of the bill, but I mean, that's certainly what Abe would like. You know, Abe sees, you know, the Chinese and the South Koreans look at Japanese textbooks, especially a small minority of Japanese textbooks that's kind of. These are school textbooks that don't mention the war. In fact, most Japanese textbooks do. But even the ones that do, the Chinese look at them and the South Koreans look at them, and they say this is hardly a kind of a real examination of what went on. Now, people like Abe look at those textbooks and say this is self-flagellation. This is painting us to be, you know, uniquely evil. And, you know, we've got to get over this. We must be proud. You know, he wrote this book, Beautiful Nation. We must look back to Tokugawa Japan and our great emperors and so forth. So this is the Abe project. I mean, I agree with you. It is frightening. I mean, I think, you know, Japan would be much better to delve into history. Japan has much to be proud of. And a lot of what it has to be proud of is post-war. You know, the problem with Abe, I think, is that he's looking pre-war to be proud. That's a pretty dangerous period of history to be proud of. If you look post-war and what Japan has done since the war, you know, the self-defense for, you know, there's been not a bullet fired in anger since the war. There is you know, like it or see it as an aberration, but there is a clause in the Constitution, Article 9, that says, you know, Japan will never go to an aggressive war. Of course, Abe wants to tear that up. You know, this is a nation that's proved that that an Asian country can become a great economic power, can challenge the West technologically. You know, a tremendous demonstrative effect to South Korea, to Taiwan, to China, to Indonesia, to the rest. There's an awful lot to be proud of. You don't need to go back to the emperor and the imperial cult and Yasukuni and all that to find stuff to be proud of. So I share your concern.
Yeah. Right at the back now.
Hello. Jacob Tome from the 2 Degrees Investing Initiative in Beijing. Thanks for sharing some of your views on Japan. I have a question that I'd also like to link to the title of your book, Bending Adversity. At least in the Western media, there was some talk of the political culture that had changed post-Fukushima, of a new consciousness among the Japanese population in terms of a new, say, democratic thinking or a new diversity, plurality of thinking in the Japanese political culture. It seems that this has somehow now disappeared, at least in the sort of mainstream debate or discourse on Japan. How would you say that? Is there, I mean, how did you see this idea?
I would be very wary of, you know, as I said, it's bending, it's not breaking. So I'd be very wary of this notion that, you know, something happens and then suddenly there's this, you know, the thing's let out the bag. I mean, in fact, if you want to talk about a big political change, that happened before Fukushima and the tsunami, because the LDP, after 50 years in power, had been kicked out prior to that. That ended in a very disappointing 3 years by the DPJ, and now the LDP is back. But I would point to a strong civil society. I mean, we tend to caricature the Japanese as sort of following orders and very hierarchical. I mean, I know kind of where that comes from. There has never been a revolution in Japan, a bottom-up revolution. But nonetheless, just to name a couple of things, one related to the tsunami and Fukushima, and one not. So in my book, there are teachers who, you know, Abe and co would call communists, who refuse to stand up to the national anthem. So it is now required in many parts of Japan that when the national anthem's played at sort of school passing out ceremonies and whatever, the teachers stand up. In fact, someone is meant to learn the Kimigayo, which is the song to the, you know, 8 million years of life to the emperor, whatever it is. And it's actually a beautiful song, but... So there are people who protect, and you know, it's quite difficult to stand up in that way in Japan. In fact, it's a rebellion, a standing up rebellion that involves sitting down because these people refuse to stand up. But that takes some guts, and there is a lot of that goes on sort of beneath the surface. And then I would just point to post Fukushima, the anti-nuclear movement that's grown. I mean, without being on either side of the debate, let's say, taking an entirely neutral stance. Japan is not the best place in the world to place 52 nuclear power stations, you know, given its seismic challenges. There are big anti-nuclear demonstrations regularly, but some of the people involved in that are Hosokawa, who's a former prime minister who may now run for the governorship of Tokyo. One, Junichiro Koizumi, staunch LDPer who's come out anti-nuclear. And one, Akie Abe, the wife of the prime minister of Japan, who has also come out as anti-nuclear. I tweeted out today that I'd love to be a fly on the wall of the Abe's bedroom, and then I went, strike that. I don't think I would really, but that shows a society where there is a certain amount of dissent. You've got the prime minister's wife slagging off her husband's policies, and a former prime minister who had in fact chosen Abe as his successor in 2006. So you know, I wouldn't see this clean break, but nor would I see civil society as strong and as robust as I would like it to be. But it is there, and it's there in surprising places. I can give you other examples.
Now, we've only got about 20 minutes left, so I'll take kind of three questions, perhaps, in section. The gentleman there, and then the two at the front here.
Just
at the end of the... Yeah, make a note. Go on.
Simon Chilton, a fellow at RUSI. I wonder if I can just draw out from your excellent talk. You explained to me, in terms that as I would understand it, that Abe is effectively a strong leader with a vision. And I put to you, that's relatively unusual in Japan. If you look kindly upon the post-war prime ministers of Japan, at most you might say there are three others, Junichiro Koizumi, Nakasone, and Yoshida, up to a point. And most of the others are often called revolving door prime ministers.
Yeah, Tanaka Kakuei, he had a vision which was...
Well, yes, but then likewise came to, shall we say, sticky end. I want to put to you, my observation is that in Japan, strong leadership is often viewed with some suspicion. And consequently, do you feel, clearly he's still very popular, even after the secrets legislation, the current popularity rate's gone back up again.
Yep.
How sustainable do you see this is? And is this connected to perhaps Gaiatsu and Naiatsu, the external and internal pressure? Your talk started with two examples of the external pressure, the Commodore Perry's black ships and the nuclear bombs. But here, you could look perhaps the tsunami as being Gaiatsu, but that in itself was not the catalyst for the changes. So is this a real change where pressure is coming from within?
All right.
Okay, and the gentleman right in the front here.
Yes, John Spencer, Labour MP and Deputy Foreign Affairs spokesman. You mentioned about the naval pressures between Japan and China.
Naval, yeah.
Yeah, but in a sense, China also has issues with a number of other countries yep. in the region, which would seem to indicate this was more driven by events from China than their relations with Japan. Secondly, with regard to the economic indicators, I think one of the areas that wasn't covered is, in fact, the huge industrial dynamism still of Japan.
Yep.
Without the loss of nuclear power, it would still be running a very heavy balance of payments yep. surplus. And right the way across the board, retreating a bit in consumer electronics, but certainly in machinery, pharmaceuticals, and advanced equipment, still way out there as a...
That's easy, I agree with you, but I can talk a little bit about
a major, that. As a major industrial factor, and maybe some of this declinism, as indeed with America, the declinism is a bit overdone.
Sure, yeah, I didn't have... But I'll go into that a bit. With
and finally, the gentleman just behind you.
Andrew Kahn. I work with both a Japanese and a Chinese company, and... In my dealings with the Chinese company, I have this illusion that I know what's going on. I think I understand the dynamics of the company. I think I understand some of the politics.
Be careful.
Yeah, I know. But I have this illusion. I have no such illusion. I'm a non-executive director of a Japanese company here in Europe, and I don't know what's going on. I mean, I really don't understand.
I'm not exactly meant to say that.
No, I understand what's going on here in Europe, where I'm a director.
Yeah, he runs a course.
But I don't understand what's happening in head office in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Now, my question really is Japanese exceptionalism that exceptional? Is it really such a different society?
Okay.
And what does that mean for Japan? The way Japan is going to conduct its international, its foreign policy, and relate to its Asian neighbours.
Right.
Three very meaty questions.
Excellent. Well, there were four disguised as three, weren't there? Abe's four arrows. Okay. So let's take them in order. Yes, Abe is a leader with a strong vision, a strong leader. I mean, he is likely to be in power until 2016. Some people are even talking, I think, fancifully about the possibility of him being there till 2020, the Olympics. This is very significant. As you say, there's been this revolving door. You know, every year you've got a new guy. Lula da Silva, the Brazilian president, was once on a stage with a Japanese prime minister, and he forgot his name. The answer, Hatoyama, by the way. But the interesting part about that story is Lula da Silva was not remotely embarrassed. He said, well, you say hello to one of them in the morning and goodbye to another one in the afternoon. Big bloody deal. And now Abe's in power for a bit. That's actually, whatever you think of Abe, that's actually good for Japan. You can do deals with Japan. You can fight with Japan, verbally. There's something to push against. I mean, I actually think that China is probably quite pleased that Abe is there, but that's a slightly different question. Is it sustainable? Yes, I think he's likely to be in power until 2016. There are scenarios that you could see where he's not, but I would give him a reasonable chance of making it to 2016. In terms of external pressure or internal pressure, I think Abe was not made in Fukushima, not really made in Japan. I think Abe was made in Beijing. I can explain that a bit more, but I think he's a creation of Beijing in a sense. He would not have been made leader of the LDP and therefore prime minister if it had not been for the sort of the Chinese pushing, the Chinese sort of freaking out about Senkaku and all of that. So, so that's answer number one. All right, so... Yeah, China's issues with other countries, this is absolutely true. So until fairly recently, the rest of Asia, and I'm talking about, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, et cetera, they were all reasonably happy about the rise of China. I mean, maybe I'm even being too cautious, maybe very happy because... China has become this kind of dynamism, this economic dynamo within Asia. And China had this, what was called smile diplomacy, the peaceful rise. It didn't even use the word rise. It didn't like the word rise. The peaceful something or other. Peaceful development. Now that has begun to shift, and you've seen China staking claims to the whole of the South China Sea. The Economist calls it the great lolling tongue hanging down. If you look at it, it's like a big tongue. It doesn't say we'll have this bit and you can have the rest. It says, you know, we're right along the coast of Vietnam, we're right along the coast of Malaysia, we're, you know, Philippines. It's all ours. It's all ours because it's on an old map. And there is a nervousness, and this was really brought home to me in December of 2012 when I was sat in the office of the Philippine foreign minister, Del Rosario. And it just occurred to me about halfway through the interview to ask him, what would you think if Abe was elected, he ripped up the constitution and rearmed, quote, unquote. Of course, Japan is armed, but it's not called an army. And expecting him to say, oh, you know, well, China, you know, we don't want to cause waves, and this would be, you know, the status quo is much better. He said in an on-the-record interview, we would be delighted, we would welcome that. And I was, you know, there's not many times, most times when you're in an interview, you kind of know what the answer is already. I was genuinely surprised. I wrote it down and we made it the splash in the paper the next day. A few months later, I was with the Indonesian foreign minister and asked him the same question and got basically the same answer. That's really quite surprising, you know, that these powers, they kind of welcome a strong Japan as a balancing force. We used to talk about India. India doesn't look so clever anymore. So, yes, I think there is a very interesting dynamic. Just to finalize that, a Pew opinion poll came out recently about attitudes to Japan and the Japanese. And, you know, they always ask, do you have a favorable, very favorable? And then they add up all the, if ever you're asked these questions, it's a cheat. So whether you say mildly favorable, favorable, or very favorable, that will all be added into favorable. What percentage of Filipinos had a favorable or very favorable impression of the Japanese? 79%. Indonesians, 80. South Korea, 13. China, 6. So you can see this divide, yeah? So it's not actually true to say that Japan is horribly unpopular in Asia. It's actually quite popular in large parts of Asia. Thailand is another. It's not popular in Northeast Asia. So, yes, it's not entirely Japan specific, but Japan is, you know, it's got that extra spice. And the industrial dynamism, you snuck in that extra question. And I have a chart, I don't think it's here, but I counted for my sins a few days ago the Fortune 500. This is after 20 years of deflation, yeah? So the Fortune 500 by revenue, not by profits, but by revenue. It may have been slightly different by profits. And I'm just out of memory. So of the top 500, 125, I think, were American. Then I think 72, something like that, were Chinese. 55, Japanese. Britain, 22. You know, France, 15. Italy, nowhere, 6 or something. Korea had a few. There is still astonishing depth in the Japanese economy, and I agree with you. I think that people have looked at the Sonys and the Panasonics going wrong, and they've concluded from that that the whole economy has gone haywire because, you know, we had Sony things in our houses and now we don't. But go to a factory in Indonesia and it's full of Japanese gear. You know, go to a building site and it's full of Komatsus and whatever. You know, all over the place. You know, there is this tremendous depth. You go to Kyoto. I mean, we think of Kyoto as temples and stuff, you know. There are companies worth $20, $30, $40 billion market cap that make, you know, tiny little things that you've never heard of, without which your life will never be the same again. Tohoku, where the earthquake and tsunami hit, is not Japan's industrial powerhouse. It's as far from Japan's industrial powerhouse as you can get. But when a wave came and knocked out some of the factories in, I think it was Mississippi, they had to close down factories because little parts that go into cars and control all sorts of things weren't reaching. And they're not only made in Japan, but the vast bulk of them are made in Japan. And there are things that are more or less only made in Japan. So I agree with you, absolutely. The industrial strength of Japan is underestimated. Right, 3. So 4. Okay, Japanese exceptionalism. This is a really interesting question. So I basically reject the idea of Japanese exceptionalism, but I pay it some service. How can I reconcile that? Well, I mean, I think that, I think Japanese exceptionalism is partly, it's manufactured. It's the story of Japan. All nations need a national myth. America has one. Russia has one. France has one. Successful nations do. You know, the Japanese is, you know, to exaggerate a touch, that, you know, they are cooperative rice farmers, not garrulous hunter-gatherers, and they are soft and emotional, not hard and logical like Westerners. You know, and the list, uniquely sensitive to nature, uniquely artistic. And this all was sort of built up during the Tokugawa phase, when Japan cut itself off largely from the rest of the world, and built upon yet again at the Meiji Restoration, when this became the kind of creed of a Japan that could separate itself from China, from rotten China that was being cut up like a melon by the West, and enabled Japan to say, we are different. We have our own culture, and we can separate ourselves off and become European. It could have two things. It could be, you know, it could have Japanese sensitivity and European technology, but it couldn't have Japanese sensitivity and Chinese Confucianism, and, you know, it had to pick two out of three kind of thing. Now, where do I give it some credence? Well, Japan clearly is different from Britain. I mean, Britain is different from France, but are France and Britain more alike than Japan and Britain? Yes, probably. But I would make a couple of observations about that. One is that let us imagine, do a thought experiment, that not Japan, but Thailand had become, from in 1950, let's say, had started to become a great industrial power, started to make cars that you wanted to drive, Sony Walkmen, machinery and whatever. You would be talking about, and so would I, until I debunked it in my book, but we would all be talking about the unique Thai culture, wouldn't we? The unique place of the Thai royal family, the unique respect language that the Thais have, which is actually very similar to the unique Japanese respect language, and the unique Thai cuisine, etc., etc., etc. We would, in other words, begin to fetishize this, which I think at its worst is what happens in Japan. Now, of course, Japan is unique. Every country is unique. And Japan is further away from the coast, the continental landmass, than is Britain. So Britain is clearly, in some senses, different from continental Europe. There are differences we could all point to. You know, our food's not as good. In Japanese,
nobody accepts that anymore.
Japanese, it's the reverse. But France and Britain are about 21 miles apart. And Japan is 120 miles from Korea. And 500 miles from China. These are big distances. They were especially big distances a long time ago. And so one can give some credence to the idea that culture sort of came along the continental landmass, you know, found its way via Korea, often into Japan, whether that be language, religion, and then kind of, you know, took a detour, stagnated, or stagnated is a bad word. I'm thinking of kind of algae in a pond. Just sort of, you know, went its sort of own way. You know, I can accept that. You know, there's a lot of water between Japan and the continent. So, and Japan can feel. Someone described it as like a womb. When you're in Japan, the rest of the world sort of faintly goes boom, boom, and the rest of the world looks. The rest of the world can look kind of scary and ugly to Japan. You know, the people fighting over these odd monotheistic religions and blowing each other up and not bowing properly and, you know, sitting in the wrong seat and. You know, the rest of the world looks very chaotic and strange. And so this reinforces this idea among some Japanese that they are unique. And it reinforces the Western idea that the Japanese are unique, and hence the misunderstanding.
Okay. Well, look, we're almost at the close. I'm going to apologize to all the other people. There are loads of other people who like to ask questions, but I will say that you will have an opportunity to pose them directly to David, because we're going to have some cheese and wine, I believe. I will actually just ask one last question of you, David, because I think it brings out something we haven't touched on. And, well, I'll also make a statement. One of the reasons I like David's work is that there are lots of us who can do analysis and economic analysis, strategic analysis. David was originally a literary student, a student of literature, and I think it shows in the way you write about people as well as about issues. And it's one of the reasons I'm looking forward to reading the book. And another thing I don't think we've maybe fully brought out, because we were so focused on the hard issues, but it's always struck me that you really love Japan, you really enjoy the place. And so perhaps I can just ask as the last question, what is it about Japan, is it possible even to answer, but that you found so appealing and that you still find so appealing?
Yeah, that is the food. when I arrived in Japan in about 2001, I just sort of, the end of 2001, in fact, I found myself in a tea ceremony on day one, you know? I was staying at a host family, and they put me right next to the tea master. So there I was, sat next to this tea master, sat in this odd Caesar-style position with my knees tucked under, and watching, kind of engrossed with this strange ceremony to my eyes, you know, that was uniquely kind of, unique, terrible word, that was choreographed, and that you knew, or you kind of felt, had been done this way for a long time, and that these movements were, you know, it's like the Issei Shrine, you know, it's like Kabuki, the actors performing the same gestures and movements in the same mie that had been done down the generations. So I watched this with some, you know, fascination. And then everybody got up to leave, and very graciously. And I, of course, my legs had gone asleep. So I was I was stuck there looking like a complete fool. And this sort of, I used this story in the book. This was kind of Japan for me. It was engrossing, it was difficult, it was challenging. And, I decided, in a sense, to embrace it. I mean, I hope I didn't leave my critical faculties behind, and I hope that what I've said tonight will show you that I didn't. But yes, I did immerse myself in what is a, you know, astonishing culture.
Okay, David, thank you very much indeed, and I hope you'll join us again.